You are tuned to KBOO Portland. The time is 5:59. Up next is Occupy Radio. Some important messages first, though, so stay tuned.
KBOO is a proud sponsor of the 4th Portland Renters Assembly and their March for Housing Rights. The assembly is on August 26th at the Midland Library from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. There will be speakers on the housing crisis and community organizing, personal stories, large and small group discussion about political strategy, but also defending and otherwise supporting each other. Snacks and childcare will be provided. The march is on August 28th. It starts at City Hall at 6 p.m. with a rally and ends at the Multnomah County Building with another assembly. The theme will be Housing Rights for All and will encompass everything from homelessness to affordable housing to tenants' rights to at-cost public housing. More information can be found at kboo.fm under Community Events or portlandrentersassembly.info.
You gotta fight for your rights!
This is Occupy Radio, covering stories of resilience and resistance, integrating activism into our everyday lives.
I want to do that in a way that doesn't gloss over the real atrocities that are happening and have happened in the past. It's not a type of unity that is, you know, singing kumbaya around a campfire and pretending like nothing is wrong. It's a type of unity that we can really only achieve by standing in the fire together and witnessing each other's suffering and being there for each other.
It's Two Tales of Hope this week on Occupy Radio. Joshua Gorman is looking for the leaders of tomorrow. He founded Generation Waking Up as a way to help motivate the millennials. Joshua shares his high hopes for the generation who will be inheriting everything we leave behind. David Temple has created Truth and Reconciliation for America. She tells us that our surest path forward is through a frank and open conversation about our cultural and personal transgressions.
Hello and welcome to all of our listeners here on Occupy Radio. I'm Rivera Sun and I am broadcasting from Maine, not from my usual home in Taos, New Mexico. I'm back in my homeland, I guess you could say, my old stomping grounds. And that laugh came from, you know him, you love him, David Getchy Sierra Lupe, also known as Getch here on Occupy Radio.
Sorry for slipping that laugh in there before you introduced me, Rivera.
The stomping grounds part kind of tickled your funny bone?
No, it was the homeland thing. You know, I was just trying to figure out, you know, what kind of homeland security efforts you had going on there in Maine.
Well, they're being very stealthy if they're tracking me. Uh-huh. We'll see if they let me cross the Canadian border when I go up to the farm in northern Maine. That'll be an adventure.
Right. That's when it all starts to come together.
Right. Uh-huh. Well, I have to say Maine is gorgeous this year. It's nice and humid, which is nice after the desert. There are no mosquitoes. I'm not sure what they did with them, but they seem to like have cleared them out of my way by some miracle here in Maine.
Was it because of the huge winter? I mean, I don't, you know, here in Eugene, we didn't have mosquitoes this summer either. I don't know. Now I'm a little concerned for our mosquito brothers.
They're pretty resilient, but I suspect they had a late frost here in Maine, and that probably killed out the hatchlings, which we're always kind of hoping for by wishing that the, you know, apple blossoms don't get caught by some miracle. Uh-huh. So it's a funny duality there. But you know what, Getch? After weeks, no, probably years, of calling for reader comments, we have a few to share today on Occupy Radio.
We do. We do, and I have to cop to something here. After all this time badgering you folks to give us your comments, we don't actually have a really good way to be notified when we get those comments. So the first comment that I've got, and I think this is a friend of yours, Rivera, Steve Conover, is that a friend of yours?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. He actually got in touch with us the day before my birthday, May 22nd. And let me read his comment real quick. Really appreciate this broadcast. All the speakers, hosts articulate issues in a clear and precise way, and unlike many other talk shows, I don't have to tweak my brain to understand what is being said. That's pretty cool stuff. I like that. I mean, he's got some other issues that he was bringing up, some technical issues, just try to get people. So if people are having problems connecting with us through Podomatic, let us know, and we're going to try to figure out how to connect that, because Steve was having some problems too. But in general, he sounds pretty happy.
Yeah, remember, listeners, you can always reach us at OccupyRadio23@gmail.com. That's also on Twitter.
And that goes right to us.
Because we can't ignore that. So let us know if you love us. Let us know if you want something to come on the show. Let us know if you want to hear something different. You know, Steve also mentioned in another comment that he had been listening to the Universal Basic Income show with Scott Santens a while back, and just that it gave him a little bit of hope and raised his spirits, because it's a bit of a radical notion. Mm-hmm. But it's also a sensible notion at this time in our world. And he appreciated that we covered it. So I appreciated hearing that. We live for feedback. It helps us get guests on the show that are interesting to you guys, our listeners, and also relevant to your interests at this time.
We're going to get to our awesome guests today, and we're going to start with Joshua Gorman of Generation Waking Up. Occupiers, we've got Joshua Gorman, who is the founder and coordinator of Generation Waking Up and a resident of Oakland, as so many cool folks you've heard on Occupy Radio are. Joshua, thank you for joining us this week on Occupy Radio.
Thank you, Gadsden Rivera. It's great to be here with you.
Joshua, I'd like to talk a little bit about what is Generation Waking Up, and maybe get into this question that everyone seems to be asking: where are the youth and what's catching their interest, and how do we connect more with youth? And you have a really particular experience, personal experience, of moving into doing engaged work with the issues of our world. And I think that might be a great place to start. And we should probably let your listeners know that, you know, this has been a bit of a journey for you. You now have a child of your own, so you're not like 16 or 17 years old. So tell us how you got started on this journey and where it's taken you.
Thank you, Rivera. Yeah, so Generation Waking Up is both a story about what's unfolding on the planet right now, with a spotlight on young people, and it's also an organization that actively works with young people ages 15 to around 30. But the story behind it really came out of my own journey as a young person. So I'm now in my mid-30s. But when I was in my mid-teens, that was the period where I started to consciously come of age and really look around at the world and start to ask those deep critical questions around how did this scene come to be? You know, why is there so much suffering? Why is there so much inequity? And also for me, just as a young human being, I was just asking those big life questions around who are we and why are we here at all? I was raised Christian, and, you know, had friends from many different religious backgrounds. But that story just, as I started to look around, it just didn't compute, right, with what I was seeing and sensing around me. So I lost the grand narrative to my life. You know, I lost the story that helped explain, you know, why the world was the way it was. So it sent me into a deep existential life crisis. And I, as a young person, I found myself very depressed, very withdrawn, starting to pull away from mainstream society. I grew up in Washington, D.C., and, you know, the heart of our nation's capital. And everybody was telling me, you know, just go to school and get a good job and, you know, just that whole American dream. And I couldn't have anything to do with it. So I was someone who dropped out of society for a bit. And I left the East Coast and I moved out to the West Coast. And I lived in Oregon for a while. And I ended up in the Hawaiian Islands. And on the Big Island of Hawaii, that is where Generation Waking Up really was born and seed and, you know, in its core vision. And it came from me kind of stepping back from the world, but also suddenly being surrounded by very conscious people who were eating healthy and people who were living in different ways and thinking about the economy and the ecology and, you know, how human beings live together in radically different ways. And I suddenly started to discover that there was a different story unfolding on the planet than just the one that I had been exposed to as a young person in Washington, D.C. And I suddenly started to connect up with and learn about all these incredible change makers and people who are just on fire with purpose and passion, helping to transform our world here at the start of the 21st century. And as my own personal realization around what was unfolding deepened, one day I had this kind of breakthrough experience where I had a bit of a download, and just, you know, in my mind, I just saw the future unfolding, and I saw these waves of social movements of young people and social unrest and healing and transformation just happening everywhere in our cities and in our society. And I saw our world kind of navigate itself through this great process of healing and transformation that one of my teachers, Joanna Macy, calls the Great Turning. So when I saw that vision, the words Generation Waking Up actually came into me, and I felt like I was gifted, you know, a vision into seeing what was happening and what our generation was being called to, you know, that we were being called to occupy the world, if I could use that language, and transform it. So I moved back to Washington, D.C., and suddenly became an activist and a social change leader and started to move and shake with some of the most amazing people out there in the environmental and social justice movements and peace movements. And within a few years, I joined forces with like-minded people, and we created an organization called Generation Waking Up to actively engage with young people. So let me pause there. Rivera, you also, you know, spoke to some other questions about what young people are doing, but let me pause there to see if there's a different direction you want to go in.
Oh no, this is great. You should. I would love to hear more about the birth of Generation Waking Up, and especially as you have these epiphanies. Are you seeing the epiphanies in the other people around you? Do you feel that you're all being pulled in the same direction? That you're having the same realizations, or is this everybody is picking up their own piece and bringing it to the puzzle?
Yeah, a little bit of both. So as I started to share my own story when I came back to D.C., I discovered that I was not alone, and that actually the story that was coming through me and the vision that I was feeling was actually showing up all around me. And so many amazing young people are feeding into this larger story that we're all a part of. And I'll be honest, I don't want to sensationalize. Like, I think we are both, young people today are waking up and working towards change, but there's just as many young people who I think are caught up in our status quo system and the mainstream paradigm, and one might say are very much asleep. But what excites me most, though, is that there is this vital, creative movement of our generation, actually, who are, you know, we're building on the generations who've been pushing for change before. And I think things are coming together, movements are coming together like never before. So one thing that's unique about Generation Waking Up is we're a broad-based youth empowerment and movement building organization. So we really connect the dots between issues, and we help young people see very clearly that, you know, our fight for environmental sustainability is directly connected with our fight for social justice. And our fight for a fair and, you know, healthy economy, and that our own personal well-being, you know, is all wrapped up in this too. And so we are really pushing for deep systemic change. And so our work unfolds through three main programs. Our first area of work is what we call our Wake Up program. And so we have some phenomenal awareness-raising programs where we take short videos and these interactive group processes, and we bring young people together in these, you know, really inspired spaces to explore four questions. We look at who are we as a generation. We look at where are we, like what's the state of the world that we're inheriting. And then we look at what has to change, and we try to really, you know, look at root causes. And then lastly, we look at, well, what do we do now? And what's, you know, that's where we discover what our role is and what our passion area is, you know, where we want to play within this broader movement. And so those really ignite the fire of young change makers. And we bring our flagship programs called the Wake Up Experience. We bring these workshops into high schools and colleges and community centers and conferences all around North America. But the second area is probably my favorite area, and that's really our leadership training work, where we bring diverse groups of young leaders who are already somewhat, you know, kind of fired up, but they want to go deeper. They want to develop skills for leadership. And we have this synthesized curriculum where we've been pulling from the best of what's out there, and we have skills and capacities that we cultivate in young leaders in the areas of personal, interpersonal, and systemic change. And for us, it's a very holistic model. We deeply believe people have to be doing the inner work of, you know, self-awareness and personal growth and emotional intelligence, and even just knowing, you know, what your inner kind of purpose and calling is, while we're also learning about conflict resolution and anti-oppression work and actually how we collaborate in groups and call forth collective wisdom and share leadership, while we also are learning skills to actually create change, you know, and launch projects or, you know, some type of social enterprise. So, you know, we're kind of training, you know, the next generation of 21st century tech-savvy bodhisattvas who are very well-rounded and really get that there's a deep fundamental shift happening on the planet. And, yeah, we all have to be pushing together for that. So the last part, I'm almost wrapping up here. The last part of our work is what we call Synergize, and that's just where we partner and collaborate with the broader ecology of social change. Like, so we hold ourselves very humbly that we're one piece of this larger web. And so, you know, the climate movement is probably where we see the most active energy within young people in North America working, you know, to transform climate change and bring about clean energy and, you know, help us kind of hospice the fossil fuel industry. And so we partner a lot with the climate movement and the climate justice efforts. But we also, right now, the Black Lives Matter movement is obviously, you know, probably the most vital and alive that we see happening. And so we rally with those movements as well. So let me pause there. We do a lot. It's a big vision, and, you know, we're just trying to play our part in that puzzle.
What are some of the reactions that you're getting from the various stages of youth, like in the high schoolers, when you come in and ask them, like, what's the state of our world? What's the state of our generation? What are the responses that you get at, say, the beginning of the workshop? We can hope that by the end of the workshop, they're coming out feeling fully empowered. But I'm curious, like, when you first interact with a group of students, what is their perspective on what's going on? And maybe as you're speaking, if you could mention like what do high schoolers think, what do college students, maybe post-college students, since you work with all three age groups?
Sure. So I just led a three-day high school training this past week, and on one hand, I'm blown away because I feel like high school students see the challenges so clearly, and they can deconstruct it all and talk about it, and they even, I would even argue that they know the solution, you know, they, or at least they know how we need to go about identifying the solutions and implementing them. So, you know, for me, there's just something about the nature of youth. I'm now in my early adulthood, so I'm no longer a youth, but I work with young people all the time, and I'm always lifting up what is the stage of youth, and there's just this awakeness in youth, and really paying attention and this critical awareness, and it's a gift for our society, you know, to really listen to our young people because they're reflecting back to us both our, you know, our shadow side, our challenges, but also what's possible, right? So high schoolers, my experience is they know what's happening in a way that's so stunning and blows people's minds to see how sophisticated their understanding can be. But there is there's a consistent experience of helplessness and powerlessness that I hear from high school students. And so it's this paradox of, like, sometimes it's unbridled idealism, like, you know, F it. Like, don't tell me I can't do that. Let's just try it. But at the same time, kind of like it's the situation is so far gone. And we were actually up at a school that was up on a kind of a hillside up above Fruitvale. And so you can look out and just see all of the bay and all of kind of Oakland. And one of the students was just saying, like, but, you know, look, yes, we can transform ourselves here and create change at our high school, but look out there. You know, this world is so broken and there's so many people out there. It's like, what can we really do? So that, I think that's really real. And in colleges and universities, there's still a tinge of that, but I start to feel more agency, more like, you know, again, this is overgeneralizing, so definitely not true across the board, but I feel like, college and university students are really just ready to, like, all right, let's get active and let's start, like, trying to create change and do this and that and really kind of pushing the edge. And then, you know, for younger folks outside of college and university, there's a deeper, I experience a deeper questing into, you know, life's purpose and calling, which is, I mean, in truth, these questions are alive all the way through from teens and into the 20s, but it's more real. Once you've left school, young people are even more on their own, and it's even more up for them, you know? It's like, who am I, and what is my greatest contribution? And, of course, the reality is starting to set in that I have to take care of myself and I need to make money. And how do I do that in a values-aligned way? And that's a huge struggle. There's a huge crisis I see amongst young people in North America around how do I make a living and make a difference? And some are finding their way in the social enterprise, social entrepreneurship space is one great possibility. But I think there's a long ways to go as, you know, young people are so clear that they want to be a part of this new world and these new systems. And yet a lot of these new systems, as you all know, aren't fully in place yet. And they're not fully flowing. And we haven't transitioned from the old economy to the new economy. It's really hard to be in that middle space.
Hey, Joshua, I'd really like to explore that sense of hopelessness and powerless, and just to keep things cheery, that you were talking about, and how do you redirect that? How do you encounter that? You know, how do you take that and bring it into these hopeful directions that you can eventually hope to channel this energy into?
That's a great question. So earlier I mentioned Joanna Macy, who has probably been the most influential person for our work. Joanna has a body of work called The Work That Reconnects, but her work originally started around despair work in the nuclear age. So Joanna's now like 84, so I forget when she even began this, but she has a lot of group processes for just honoring our pain is the language they use. And so we feel it's really important for, you know, young people to feel so that they can heal. But also it's, you know, we help young people get vocal and vulnerable about the pain and the fear and the suffering and the apathy and the hopelessness. Because our experience is that that becomes the fire that sustains them and fuels them, right, to go out there and create change. So we create really safe containers for vulnerability where young people can, even break into tears and you know, let their heartbreak come out. And that is very healing and restorative. But from that too, then we also then connect young people up with the whole history of social change. You know, we're not the first generation to be called to do great things when it seemed like nothing was possible. And so we both share past stories of both social movements and even young leaders and how much they've done. And then we also share current stories of what young people are doing. And that just, you know, it just, that's what then fills them with that sense of hope and possibility. So that's, you know, that's our model. We try to keep it real, and we try to be really clear, like it's healthy to be feeling all those things, and just to actually learn to be with it, and let it work through you. And it's actually a really healing process, but, you know, as I shared, a very motivational process.
Joshua, I know a lot of our listeners are engaged in different movements or organizations working on social issues, and a lot of them are questioning with each other and with their own movements. This question of how to engage youth in the movements and the issues. Now, you guys are working directly with youth and really working on awakening them. If any of our listeners are wanting to do that work as well, how do they connect with Generation Waking Up, and how do they go deeper with their own skills and ability to connect with youth in their area?
So we welcome relationships with people from all over, and definitely you can find us at generationwakingup.org and let us know what you're thinking about or wanting to do or a challenge or idea you have. So, you know, young people love to just be invited to the conversation. And I think for older folks, sometimes you have the natural gift to kind of mentor and empower young people and actually include them in a conversation or an action or a process in a really healthy way. But, you know, as someone who's kind of in the in-between stage now, I'm also really aware that there, you know, as adults, there is a power over that often plays out, right? When especially young people in their teens and early 20s are included in the process. And so just being extra sensitive to that, you know, making sure that you're not dominating the space or the conversation, and that you're really, truly, empowering and lifting up and even inviting in the leadership of these young people and really listening to them. Like, young people long to be seen and heard. And so just listening to them and affirming them, that is such a powerful place. I would also, on the flip side, say, though, sometimes I see adults then who are oversensitive to not wanting to kind of take up too much space, and then they hold back, you know, and all they're doing is supporting the younger person's leadership. But I'm a believer that that our world is calling on all generations to come together. And actually there's a wisdom and an alchemy and, you know, kind of a synergy that can only come to life when we partner across generations. And so it's just as important as adults, and sometimes we say youngers, olders, and elders. So olders and elders need to bring their truth, their vision, their voice just as much. And we just, like any group where there's diversity and difference, we need to be sensitive and making sure everybody is getting, shared space and being honored for their different contributions.
So it takes a village to save the world.
It truly does, yeah. Uh-huh. We have a saying, it takes a whole generation to change the world. And, by whole generation we speak, everyone alive today is actually part of one living generation.
All right. Well, we've got Joshua Gorman here, folks, founder and coordinator of Generation Waking Up. And Joshua, this has been a great conversation. Lots of hope, I feel, coming out of this for the future. And I want to thank you for coming on Occupy Radio.
Thank you both. It's great to support your work. Keep it going.
And if people are looking you up, what's the link they can go to?
Yeah, www.generationwakingup.org or just facebook.com/generationwakingup.
Excellent. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And that was great to hear from Joshua Gorman of Generation Waking Up. I found that made me feel really very hopeful, not only that the youth are engaging, but that there are leaders working in that field to help connect them with what they're curious about. We're really changing and transforming our society, not just baby steps at a time, but major steps at a time. Kind of goes into the theme of the next interview, which is with David Temple about Truth and Reconciliation Hearings for America. Listening to Occupy Radio from KWVA Eugene and the Pacifica Radio Network, streaming at kwvaradio.org and podcasting at occupyradio.org.
If you're listening to this show, Occupiers, chances are good that you're the type of person who wants to know where people are fighting injustice so that you can lend your support. Rivera and I are fighting injustice each week by bringing you stories of activism and injustice and even interviews with your fellow activists. We could sure use your help, and we're not asking for much. Stars is all we're asking for. We want stars on iTunes and Stitcher, and we make it easy to do. On OccupyRadio.org, right under this week's show, we've got links to iTunes and Stitcher. Give them a click, and right away, you'll feel like you're doing something to help bring about change. Go ahead and give Occupy Radio some stars. It's easy. Rivera and I would love to hear from you, and we will definitely give you a shout-out on the show. And now we're with David Temple, who is the founder and director of Truth and Reconciliation for America, a much-needed topic, I think, Occupiers. And Deva, thank you for coming on Occupy Radio.
Thank you, Getch.
Deva, I ran across you on Facebook when a friend said, hey, there's this amazing group that's trying to do truth and reconciliation processes for America, which could probably use about 1,000 years of these. Why don't we start with what got you interested in this and where the project is at right now?
Well, I recognized a need for truth and reconciliation after having a couple of interactions with people of color who were angry with me. And they really had no reason to be. They didn't know me as a person. It was really just that I am perceived as white, even though most of my ancestors are indigenous, but I pass as white. And I began to recognize that there is a righteous anger in black communities that I haven't really been aware of most of my life. And rather than becoming defensive and saying, well, I'm not a racist personally, blah, 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 I decided to really stop and listen. And I recognized that there was something really worthwhile in the act of listening to someone who's angry with me just because of the suffering that they have experienced. And I learned through that process that by having empathy for others, by setting aside the sort of reaction, the sort of defensive reaction to want to defend myself, I could actually create bridges. And then I started thinking about how this process could happen on a wider scale and create more understanding, creating healing, creating unity, and actually looking at the truth of what has happened in this country with slavery, with Jim Crow, with segregation, with lynchings, and even into this day with the police violence that we see against members of the Black community, with the way that Black people are portrayed in the media. I think it's okay to talk about all of these things. And I think that, you know, I haven't had to live with the reality of that personally, but I can afford to make myself uncomfortable and actually hear people for whom that is the reality and they can't escape it. And so I decided that I really wanted to create a space, a forum, if you will, where marginalized and oppressed people of many different identities could come forward and speak the truth of their experience and be heard and listened to and respected. So that's really what I'm doing. And to answer the second part of your question, where we're at right now is we have formally incorporated as a nonprofit organization, and we are seeking collaboration from organizations and individuals who have the capacity to teach us something, who could come and do training with us, and also from leaders of the Black community, from leaders in Native American communities and in GLBT communities and in other communities that experience marginalization and oppression. We're asking for leaders to step forward who are interested in joining with us in this process. So that's really where we're at right now. And we're working on developing our rather large web presence because we plan on making liberal use of new media and internet technology.
So for me right now, I guess I'm drawn to the structural elements and where, I guess, if you're reaching out, you want to pull people back together. Are you pulling people together to interact with a virtual community? Is that the plan, or is there a physical element? Do you foresee, communities locally growing around this as well? How do we bring all this truth and reconciliation together, I guess is my question.
Well, yeah, that's a great question. I think it's not either or, it's all and. And so, yeah, what I have found is that movements that really start online, they don't have a vast impact unless those movements really take to the streets and to the community.
Hear, hear.
And engage in the political process. So I see the two in terms of actual work in the communities and using online media to disseminate our findings and to raise awareness and to get more people involved. They go hand in hand. So I definitely don't plan on staying just online, but we're definitely going to use all the tools available to us to raise awareness and get our message out there and get more people involved. The way I see it working on a technical level and sort of structure of the organization is that we'll provide a foundation of training to begin with a core group of organizers and activists in communities that are interested in this sort of thing. And we'll bring in some people who have helped with the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions in other countries and also in North Carolina and in Maine. And we'll also be bringing in some experts in nonviolent communication, some teachers from the Virtues Project that teach about compassion and empathy, and other educators that can help us just generally to learn how to communicate more effectively and be better people, be able to connect with each other better. And so then the leaders that step into that first level of training, we're asking them to make a commitment to participate as teachers down the road and to train other people in how to use this tool. It's really a communication tool. And so the vision is to have thousands of truth and reconciliation groups and meetings that actually get together in communities where there has been some sort of wrongdoing, some sort of deep wound that needs to be addressed. And that wound could be ongoing, or it could be something from the past, or both. And we're going to provide them with the tools to really have those conversations, and also with the tools to post, you know, videos to YouTube, to make use of the blog, to make use of the potential for viral, for information to go viral online. So by doing this, we're really about empowering people, and we're not going to set the agenda for the local communities. We really want to empower the community members and the community leaders to set their own agenda, because we recognize that the United States is a very diverse country. There have been a lot of institutionalized forms of oppression, and that really we can't understand from a central level what each community needs most. So we're more like a hub for providing education, information, funding, resources, and just some how-to knowledge on how to do this.
Great, Deva. I think, you know, we actually should rewind a little bit for all of our listeners who may be scratching their heads and saying, Truth and Reconciliation Commission or hearings, that sounds familiar. Where do I know that from? You know, we had a famous example in South Africa, but then you also mentioned one in Maine. I happen to be sitting in Maine right now and just talked to some people who are a part of, I think, the same one you're referencing. Mm-hmm. But maybe you could talk about those two, one that's historic and fairly well known, and then this one that's happening in Maine, and what we can draw from the understanding of what a Truth and Reconciliation hearing is.
Sure. Well, I think, like most of your listeners, I myself, you know, I heard of Truth and Reconciliation from the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission that was implemented at the fall of apartheid. And I was a child pretty much then, and I didn't really understand what was going on, but I heard about it, and then later on heard more when I was in college that it was part of a process that allowed for the country to transition out of apartheid without falling into civil war, and actually allowed for people to come together after a long history of institutionalized segregation. And what I didn't realize is that actually Truth and Reconciliation Commissions have been happening for a while. Some of the earliest of them were in South American countries that had been ruled under military dictatorships. And when they came out from those military dictatorships, a lot of atrocities had happened and there was a lot of wounding. And so Truth and Reconciliation Commissions were formed to discover what actually had happened and acknowledge the truth of that as a first step in the healing process. And also often in the case in South Africa included the ability for perpetrators of state violence to receive amnesty if they fully disclosed what they had done. So that has been a feature. And then moving forward, there have been Truth and Reconciliation Commissions. Most of them, all of them that I am aware of, have been government-led in Sierra Leone, Liberia. And one is just wrapping up in Canada. It's actually been looking at abuses that went on in the Native American school system. They call them First People in Canada is the name that they use. And they had a school system much like we had here in this country that forced Indigenous people to send their children into schools to be assimilated into dominant culture. So that is just wrapping up in Canada, and I've been in contact with them. And then we had a couple of states here in Greensboro, North Carolina in 1979. There was a KKK massacre that happened there, and the community had a hard time reconciling and coming back together after that. So they decided to implement a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And also the main, forgive me if I'm mispronouncing this, but I believe it's Maine Wabanaki State Child Welfare Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was looking at how children were treated in the in the welfare system and in the foster care system and the abuses that may have gone on there. So there's been a long history at this point, a decades history of countries and local state governments implementing Truth and Reconciliation Commissions from a governmental level. And what's different about what we're doing is we're doing it from a grassroots level. We're doing it, it's a citizen-led thing. So obviously we don't have access to tools like offering amnesty. And so the focus is much less on legal issues and determining the extent of human rights abuses that have gone on. And it's much more focused on how can we learn to listen to one another in a way that is humane and to acknowledge the painful things that have gone on and continue to go on and to come together as one human family. So, and I want to do that in a way that doesn't gloss over the real atrocities that are happening and have happened in the past. It's not a type of unity that is, you know, singing kumbaya around a campfire and pretending like nothing is wrong. It's a type of unity that we can really only achieve by standing in the fire together and witnessing each other's suffering and being there for each other.
I want to embrace everything you're saying, Deva. It sounds wonderful, and I want to figure out how ready is America for this step.
You know, I don't know. That remains to be seen. It seems from my experience and my perspective, which is limited, that there are a number of people who are really willing to engage in this process and who welcome it. And there are, of course, variations in how willing each of us are at different points in our lives. It can be a painful experience to look another human being in the eye, to see them as a person and not a nameless, faceless online presence or protester, but to actually be in the same room with someone and to hear their real life story, which is sometimes a story that you could not even imagine happening to you or anyone that you love, and to recognize that that's the reality that we are all to some degree or another participating in. I think it takes a lot of courage. And so I really want to commend everyone who has stepped up so far and expressed an interest in this, and people who will come forward in the future. I think that there's a lot of denial in this country that there is any sense of racism or institutionalized racism or oppression. And we sort of want to pretend like everything that happened that was wrong was in the past, and we're beyond that now. And there's really no need for a social justice movement of any kind. And I understand the desire to get to a good place and to feel good. I think that's inherent in all of us. And it's part of the human spirit. It's part of our ability to be resilient. And so I don't want to dismiss it completely, but I'd like to ask people to just really step back for a second and recognize that some of us are living really good lives. Some of us are very much privileged in many ways that are invisible to us, and others have been left behind, and others live in fear on a daily basis. And we have a responsibility to one another. So I'm not sure how big this is going to get, how fast, but the need for it is there. And as long as the need is there, it's going to keep pushing it forward.
I think the example you gave with the Wabanaki Confederation is really an important example of how present the need is. You know, I grew up in Maine, and, you know, as a white person, and the need is really on both sides. And it's not just, from my perception, it's not just for one generation or a one-time thing. It's actually something every person needs to walk through around our very bloody and challenging history. And also there's many layers to the truth and reconciliation that needs to happen. The mythology of that white people are always the oppressor, and also the mythology that, you know, people of color will always be oppressed, you know, the whole dialectic of victim and victimized has to fall apart. And truth and reconciliation is one way through that paradigm. But so that's a question I'd like to ask you. Do you envision this in the local communities as being a one-time occurrence or potentially a recurring event, something that, say, a community does annually?
You know, that's a good question. I would leave it up to those communities that engage in it if they find real value in that process and it's something that they want to do on a reoccurring basis. I am in complete support of that. It's sort of like in any family system or roommates or a marriage or long-term relationship, you know. If you don't talk about the little things that are painful for you, they build up. And it becomes harder to speak about them over time. And so having a regular practice of communicating about issues before they become out of control and so big and hurtful is a really good way to maintain good relationships. And that's on any level. So, of course, having this be an ongoing thing would be ideal. And it's really just, I'd like people to look at it as a tool. It's just another tool in our toolkit of how to be a good human being, how to be a good community member, how to be a good citizen, and a good person. So being able to go into this process and really engage in it is it's something that helps us to grow as people. But I want to go back to what you said really quickly about the narrative that white people are always the oppressor and black people will always be oppressed. And I just want to really broaden the discussion to include a multitude of identities and that it's not just about black people and white people in the history of racism. And it's not about painting one group of people as always the oppressor or always the oppressed. I want to recognize as well that there is a deep suffering that comes from being a part of a group that has benefited from an institutionalized form of oppression, and that there is a part of each of us that experiences privilege on some level, whether you're a black man and you're experiencing privilege as a male, or a white woman who's experiencing white privilege, or if you have any level of wealth in your family and you're experiencing that kind of privilege, or if you're heterosexual, or if you fit into any of the groups that are generally awarded a greater degree of respect in our culture, then you have some degree of privilege. I have privilege, even though in many ways I have not had privilege. So you're right. It's a much more complex discussion. And I want to create room for all of that to be heard without it becoming a contest of who is most oppressed. It's not about deciding who's most oppressed or who's right and who's wrong and who's good and who's bad. Those ideas don't do us any good. They don't get us anywhere. What it's about is just creating space for people to share their lived experience and be heard by people who might not understand that without really being present and witnessing it in another human being.
That's great. You actually covered the question I was going to ask next, which was, I can't wait for Truth and Reconciliation class, income and wealth in the U.S., since we have one of the greatest wealth divides in this country. And it actually is a deep seam of hurt and wounding in this country. You know, what would Occupy 2.0 look like if it was about truth and reconciliation between the 1% and the 99%? I think it'd be very powerful, very interesting. It would bring up a lot of our history and the way we relate to one another. Very, very interesting to consider the many applications of this truth and reconciliation process. I want to remind the listeners, just as we're about to close this discussion, that we are talking with Deva Temple, who is the founder and director of Truth and Reconciliation for America. And Deva, if any of our listeners are out there thinking, oh my gosh, I can imagine I have 17 issues that we could apply this to, how can they get a hold of you and how can they get involved? And if they're the kind of listener who is curious about how can I be a part of the group that is helping to popularize truth and reconciliation, how can they do that as well?
Well, right now what we have is we are setting up our website and we're still working with a Gmail address. So that address, if you want to reach me by email, is truthandreconciliationforus, all one word, @gmail.com. And soon when our website is online, we will have a new email address we'll make available as well, and we'll have a contact form. That website will launch in about a week. It's going to be a little bit bare bones, but we'll build on that. And currently, right now, we're having the greatest momentum on Facebook, where we have a group, Truth and Reconciliation for America, and we also have a page, which is also Truth and Reconciliation for America. So anyone is welcome to send a request to join the group or follow that page. And yeah, those are the best ways to reach us and get involved at this point. And if anyone wants to offer, you know, their experience, their abilities to this cause, we would welcome that. So, and in closing, I just want to say that really, we are at our weakest when we are divided. And those who wish to maintain control over the masses want us to be divided. And so all of the dissension that goes along, whether it's race, class, gender, sexual orientation, religious affiliation, those really just serve as distractions to keep us fighting with each other over crumbs. And so what we're really about is creating real unity. And that's where our greatest power lies.
All right. Well, I will get out there to Facebook and connect with you on those fronts, because I am definitely interested in seeing how this goes, because I feel like this, you're right, this is the crucible eventually that America has to pass through in order to get to the next phase. So thank you for everything you're doing, Deva, and definitely thank you for coming on Occupy Radio this week.
Thank you.
And so that was Deva Temple. I want to thank her for coming on, talking about Truth and Reconciliation. As I said at the end of the interview, very important. I'm very excited to hear that. I think it's something we have to do. And thanks at the beginning of the show to Joshua Gorman of Generation Waking Up. A very good feeling show this week, Rivera.
We always try, you know, stories of resistance and resilience. It's a two-sided coin that helps us make change happen. Gotta let the listeners know we are listening to Occupy Radio, which is produced through KWVA 88.1 FM on the campus of the University of Oregon. And we are syndicated on the Pacifica Radio Network. I want to thank, as always, my wonderful co-host, David Getchy, Sierra Lupe.
Hey, I want to thank Eric and Stephen for reaching out to us, and I hope you all out there are motivated to get in touch. We've got a lot to talk about. You can reach us at Occupy Radio 23 on Twitter and Gmail. You can always find us on Stitcher and iTunes, where we are Occupy Radio. And we would love to have some 5-star reviews or any kind of reviews. You can also find us at the Occupy Radio group page on Facebook, and everything Occupy Radio is at occupyradio.org.
And for Occupy Radio, I am Rivera Sun. You know, listeners, there are 1.5 billion teenagers in the world today. A generation waking up is attempting to wake up the 42 million of those teenagers that are living in the U.S. So take a look around, listeners. Maybe there's a teenager near you that is longing to be heard and seen.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. Up next is Hard Knock. And a little bit of information you might find interesting. Keep it tuned here to KBOO Portland.
Looking for a career? KBOO is proud to be a co-sponsor of Oregon's 15th Annual Diversity Employment Day Career Fair. The fair will be held Wednesday, August 26th, from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the Ambridge Events Center, located at 1333 Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in Portland. Participants may interview with over 50 major employers who are recruiting for hundreds of positions. The career fair is sponsored by the DiversityRecruitersNetwork.org. Business attire is required and bring plenty of resumes. More information is available at citycareerfair.com or on the right-hand side of the KBOO homepage at kboo.fm.
Hard Knock. KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the African Hip Hop Caravan Benefit Show, August 29th, from 3 to 6 p.m. at Columbia International Cup in Portland. All ages are welcome to this benefit show featuring Mike Crenshaw and Rashid Jamal to raise funds and awareness for their November trip to various countries in Africa. Again, that's a benefit show for the African Hip Hop Caravan on Saturday, August 29th, from 3 to 6 p.m. at Columbia International Cup, 9022 North Newman Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. Peace.
It's the H-I-P to the H-O-P, it's the movement. Hip-hop caravan, it's the H-I-P to the H-O-P, it's the movement. Hip-hop caravan.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
It's history, it's history. Never been done before.
But I tell you today, rabbit hunting is done. When the rabbits stop running and start fighting back.
We're talking about a subject. We're talking about a subject.
Fam, you're tuned to Hard Knock here on the Pacifica Network. Up next on the program, we hear from former political prisoner and Black Panther BLA member Daruba Bin Wahad as he talks about the rise of the police state, a speech that was given some time ago at the National Hip Hop Political Convention. This is something that we wanted to play to wish our comrade a speedy recovery and send him well.